it's awesome to see, I don't want to say it's many old faces, like so many returning faces. This thing's actually dying.
No, okay. Anyway, it's really awesome to look out and see this room so full and see so many people coming back, but also see so many new faces. It's awesome. So as Christina said, I hope you find this to be a place where you can study God's word and feel like you come to know him better, and that you also really find a home in your small group when you get placed in that next week, and that you meet some women there that really you feel like become friends and that you can walk through life with. So, James, there was a short summer study several years ago. I don't know if any of you, Marilee, I think, was in it, that I participated in. Okay, Leslie and Julie in the back there, too. And I remember being really challenged by this letter, and I think it's because it talks about so many things that we deal with in everyday life. So I'm looking forward to a more in-depth study, and for those of you who have studied it before, or if you haven't, I hope you guys are looking forward to this study as well. So this morning, I'm going to start out with some background information on James, and then I'm going to talk about who this letter was written to, and some reasons why Bible scholars think that he probably wrote it. And then lastly, I'm going to touch on some of the major topics in the letter. So first, some general background information on James. He was the oldest half-brother of Jesus, and he was a full brother of Jude, who also wrote a letter that's part of the New Testament. So I started thinking about this idea of James growing up with Jesus as a sibling. They shared an earthly home. They shared earthly parents. And I started to wonder what it must have been like for him to grow up with somebody who is actually perfect. We're told in Luke that the child about Jesus, that the child grew and became strong. He was filled with wisdom, and the grace of God was upon him. Now, some of you guys sitting out here this morning, you might have grown up with a sibling that you felt was perfect, right? At least compared to you, they always did things right, and maybe you didn't. Or maybe you had a sibling that you secretly suspected was your mom or your dad's favorite. But think about James. I mean, the poor guy. It really, from his perspective, it had to have been, at times at least, a frustrating or annoying family dynamic, because he really did have a perfect sibling. Someone who probably always did things better than he did. I mean, I have to assume Jesus didn't go through the terrible twos. He probably didn't morph into a moody teenager. And how could Mary, how could his mother not have looked at him differently than her other children, because they were all too human, which meant they were always sinning all the time. But despite that unique vantage point that James had growing up as a sibling with Jesus, maybe because he literally did know him as one of the siblings that he grew up with in the impoverished town of Nazareth, and he knew him as someone who is training to be a carpenter, it might not be too surprising that James initially rejected Jesus when he claimed to be the Messiah. But we know from 1 Corinthians that James was one of the people who personally saw the resurrected Christ, and that after that saving experience, James, along with Peter, became one of the leaders of the church in Jerusalem. James was eventually martyred for his faith sometime around 62 AD, which is the period of time when Paul was probably under house arrest in Rome, which is when he wrote the two letters that we all studied last year, if you were here in the study, Ephesians and Philippians. And most Bible scholars think that James was writing primarily to Jewish believers, people who were being punished for following Jesus, and that those people had been scattered as a result of the unrest that occurred that was recorded in Acts chapter 12. Those events in Acts happened when a man named Herod Agrippa was ruling northern Palestine, Judea, and Samaria. And that was a post that he had been given after he ran up some debts in Rome, and he was actually thrown in prison for a while by the emperor Tiberius. So because Herod Agrippa had this sort of shaky relationship with Rome, he tried to curry favor with the local Jews by persecuting Christians. So he had the first apostle, another man named James, but a different James. He had the first apostle martyred, and he also had Peter arrested. Sometime probably around 37 to 44 AD, which is when he was ruling over this territory. Now, after Peter subsequently got out of prison and left the area, our James assumed full leadership of the church in Jerusalem. Now, the believers in this church and the ones that he wrote his letter to, as I mentioned before, we think were primarily Jewish converts to Christianity. We have a couple clues about this. One is that James makes more than 40 allusions to the Old Testament in his letter, and he doesn't explain any of them. And this would make sense if he was writing to a Jewish audience who would understand, would know, be very familiar with the Old Testament, and they wouldn't require any explanation of those allusions. Another clue is that he refers 15 times to the people that he's writing his letter to as brethren, which is a term that was very commonly used by first century Jews. Now, I mentioned earlier, many of the people who were facing persecution in this area that was being ruled over by Herod Agrippa had scattered to other places outside of Israel to escape the persecution. And that's probably why James begins this letter by addressing it to the 12 tribes who are dispersed abroad. That's how first century Jews living outside of Israel thought of themselves. They still considered themselves part of the 12 tribes, which is how God's people were described in the Old Testament. So the fact that James addresses his letter in this way also points very strongly to the fact that he was writing to Jewish Christians who were now living outside of Israel. We're going to see that his letter doesn't include many of the customary greetings or travel plans or references to fellow workers that Paul often includes in his letters. And while there are also no references to specific people or places in the body of the letter, it does seem to address a specific set of circumstances, and that's the reason most Bible scholars think that he was writing to a specific group of churches located outside of Israel, which again were probably made up primarily of Jewish converts. Now, when you're studying James, many Bible scholars also think it's very helpful to know that while the early church was grappling with this idea, which was revolutionary at the time, and that's the idea that Gentiles as well as Jews could be God's people, and that while James absolutely accepted and believed this, that the best way to say it is that he still maintained his essential Jewishness. The way one commentary described this is that James wrote this letter not as a Jewish Christian, but he wrote it as a Christian Jew. He maintained a real affinity for Jewish believers, and he was careful to maintain the confidence of these people, many of whom had previously been very zealous about keeping the law as the only way to please God. And if you think about it from a practical standpoint of wanting to share the gospel, it was important for the church that James headed up to maintain good relationships with nearby synagogues so that their church could continue to have outreach opportunities there. Now, we don't know what happened to the church in Jerusalem after the death of James and after the temple was destroyed a few years later. Historians never recorded whether that church in Jerusalem maintained its distinctly Jewish character while it was in exile. What we do know is that before that temple was destroyed, and remember, that's the place where God's people could come to be in his presence, that before that temple was destroyed, that the legacy of James and all the other New Testament writers was secure, and that's because a new cornerstone had already been laid, and God had already begun to build a new living home where he now dwells, which is inside you and it's inside me. Now, even though Jesus is mentioned only twice in this letter, his presence permeates it. And that's because James draws straight from his teaching and he weaves it throughout the letter. The way that one commentary described it is that this letter is soaked in the words and the wisdom of James' older brother. Now, as Paul sometimes did in his letter, James introduces himself at the very beginning as a bondservant of both God and Christ Jesus. Now, in the first century, a bondservant was typically a slave, but James uses this word the same way that Paul did, which is in its Hebrew sense, which means they were both describing themselves as a servant who willingly commits himself to a master that he loves and respects. So what does James write about after he introduces himself this way? What is it that we're going to be learning from him this fall? Well, I think that what we're going to find is that James writes to his audience about very practical things, issues that they encountered in their daily lives and that we will encounter or are encountering or have encountered in our lives today as well. And he teaches about these things using many easy-to-understand, everyday illustrations from nature, things like wind-blown waves, the scorching heat of the sun, and a vanishing mist. And as Christina alluded to, he deals with challenging aspects of daily life in a very direct manner, and he doesn't waste any time. We're going to see next week that he jumps right into a very difficult topic in literally verse 2 of the letter. We'll also see that his letter doesn't have a real obvious structure, or even a clearly defined theme, and then he moves from topic to topic pretty quickly. We'll also see that James doesn't dwell a lot on theology. He actually says very little about many basic Christian doctrines, probably because he wrote this letter to address a specific set of problems among people that he knew understood their theology. So we'll see that he's much more concerned with how the people that he's writing to are living out their beliefs. As we go through James, we're going to be studying passages that are very practical in terms of their application to our lives, because they have to do with things that we've all encountered or will encounter. Things like facing temptations, going through trials, how we should speak, how we should think about and use money. So here are a few highlights of what James is going to teach us in this study. He's going to teach us about facing trials and what comes from that. When we are brought to our knees by hardship or trials, we're forced to depend on God to get through whatever it is we're facing. I think, like this slide depicts, we've all probably experienced how true it is that that very dependency brings us closer to God. We turn to God when our circumstances force us to acknowledge that we have nowhere else to go. Another important idea that one of the commentaries that I read brought out, pointed out, is that patient endurance in the face of trials, that's actually God's chosen way forward to maturity for his people. And this idea is found throughout scriptures, as we can see from all the verses that are cited in this slide, which is titled, Why Me, God? We can see that several verses are quoted, including Isaiah, Lamentations, and Romans. Here's what we read in Isaiah. But those who hope in the Lord when they're facing a trial will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. And we can read in Lamentations that the Lord's loving kindnesses indeed never cease, for his compassions never fail, even when we're in the midst of trials. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. And then finally, we read what Paul wrote in Romans, which is that we also rejoice in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance character, and character hope. Here's what James teaches about the same idea of perseverance in the face of trials. Perseverance must finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. When we persevere in our faith when we're in anguish, that ultimately leads us to a more mature faith, to a closer relationship with God, to more trust in him. And how we deal with trials also can give us a great opportunity to be a witness to other people, especially non-believers. So we can give God glory and we can show his love to other people by the way that we deal with our trials. And I think all of those things, a more mature faith, a closer relationship with God, the chance to give him glory, and the chance to show his love to other people are all part of the joy that James is going to teach us can come from trials and can come from having our faith tested. Another issue that James addresses in this letter is the fact that we're all going to face temptations. We might not be tempted by the same things, but we all will be tempted. Not by God, because he's perfectly holy, he's not capable of evil. Typically, we face temptations when we're baited and carried away by our own desires. With a little help from Satan, which I think this slide brings that point home, it's our own sinful thoughts and actions that lead us astray. And just like trials, what we're going to see is that temptations test our faith, and that here too, if we can be faithful and we can persevere in the face of temptations, we'll become more mature in our faith and closer to God. James is also going to teach us about a couple of other things that we probably all know but might still hit a little bit close to home for comfort. The first one is that we need to control our tongues. And the second one is that putting our efforts into serving vulnerable people, that's really the best way that we can show our devotion to God. Now, James specifically calls his audience to care for widows and orphans, probably because in his first century culture, they were among the most powerless, the most vulnerable people. So I don't think in our day and age we need to feel constrained to only serving widows and orphans. I think the idea is simply to serve other people who are in need and that our service is a manifestation of our faith, and it's a way to show our love for God by serving these other people. I think what we're going to find is that the point that James makes here is that knowing and understanding Christian theology isn't as important as what he calls the royal law, which is loving your neighbor as yourself. James very clearly calls his readers to a faith that shows itself through service to needy, marginalized, and disenfranchised people. And one of the commentaries that I read pointed out something about this particular point that I never really thought about. And what this commentary said was that serving other people shouldn't be viewed as something that's optional, something that we try to do to be more like Jesus, but instead that meeting the needs of other needy people is really a central an obligatory part of our faith, and that the reason for that is that at the heart of our own salvation is a God who, through his compassion, reached out to us when we were the needy people. And so for believers, the compassion that we show to other people mirrors what God did for us, and it's proof of the work of God's grace in our hearts. Now, to go back to that first issue, controlling the tongues, we'll see that James is addressing an issue here that runs throughout the Bible. We can read in 1 Peter that whoever would love life and see good days must keep his tongue from evil and his lips from deceitful speech. And as you can see from the verse below, he's basically just paraphrasing Psalm 34, which says the exact same thing. Now, one of the commentaries that I read said that James looks at this issue of the tongue not just as an index of our spiritual health. And when I say that, I mean that idea that what comes out of your mouth reflects what's going on in your heart. But that James also thinks it's something more important. That he actually thinks that the tongue is the key to our spiritual well-being. Now, that's a pretty big statement, if you think about it, that he backs that up by writing about the tongue, and he uses illustrations in chapter 3. We'll learn that when we get there. He uses illustrations of a horse, a ship, and fire. To summarize, what he's going to teach us there is that if we can master our tongues, we can control all the energies of our lives, much like putting a bit in the mouth of a horse to control it. That we can steer our way through the winds of circumstance, just like a small rudder steers a ship. And that we can set bounds around the fiery and destructive forces within our human natures. And that the key to doing all of those things lies in controlling our tongues. We'll also see that James is going to have some very straightforward and challenging teaching on how we handle our money. Or maybe I should say God's money that he's chosen to have us be stewards of. We're going to be asked to consider the line between saving, which is a good thing, and hoarding, which is not. In chapter 5, we're going to read how James excoriates the rich, whom he says have lived on earth in luxury and self-indulgence. Hey, did anybody out there like secretly cringe, at least on the inside, when I read that? I mean, do you wonder, was he looking ahead to present-day Orange County when he wrote that? I think this issue is going to be a tough one for many of us who live here. My husband and I recently finished building ourselves a beautiful new home, so this issue really hits home for me, particularly right now. So the question here is, when I'm willing to spend so much money on myself and my family, when there's so many people out there with very basic needs, you know, am I not following what James calls the royal law, which is loving your neighbor as yourself? Did I mention I found this letter personally challenging? So this is a good example of that. And then, of course, there are probably what are the most challenging and debated verses in James, which have to do with the intersection of faith and works. The question that Bible scholars have argued for years is whether the emphasis that James puts on works somehow contradicts Paul's focus on grace and faith in all of his writings as the source of our salvation. So first, a little background on this issue. Most Bible scholars think that James wrote his letter before the famous council in Jerusalem in 49 AD. What that means is that James wrote his letter first before any or all of Paul's writings. So James was writing about a very practical understanding of faith, independently of what Paul would later teach. When Paul was teaching about faith, he was talking about the source of our righteousness. We're found to be righteous before God because of our faith in what Jesus did for us. When James is talking about works, he's talking about how we demonstrate the fact that we're now righteous, we're now seen as without sin in God's eyes. James never says that works will save us from our sin. What he does say is that true faith will show itself in a life of good works. And when we're reading verses from Paul's letters that talk about salvation only by faith, and then we compare that to James, who puts so much emphasis on works, it's also very helpful to know that these two men had different audiences that they were writing to and different problems that they were addressing. James was combating the issue of a superficial faith that had no effect on the life of the professed believer. And that's why James puts so much emphasis on works as being the evident fruit of true faith and salvation. Paul, on the other hand, was often dealing with a very different problem. He was combating something called legalism, which is the belief that you can earn God's favor by your good works. And that's why Paul puts so much emphasis on understanding that there's no amount of good works that will allow us to earn our salvation. So when you know that Paul and James had two very different goals for what they wanted their audiences to understand, it does go a long way towards explaining why they focus on the critical importance of two seemingly opposite things, faith on one hand versus works on the other. But the question still remains, how do we balance these two ideas? Can they both be of central importance at the same time? Well, just before I began preparing to teach this overview, so reading through James and reading through commentaries, I was reading a book by Francis Chan on a totally different subject. It was on marriage. And in the section of his book that I started reading to get a flavor for what he was going to be talking about, he was writing about the importance of acting on what you've learned, responding to truth when you recognize it. And he said something, he went on to say something then that I thought really rang true for both what he was trying to say in his book, but also for our study of James. This is what Francis Chan said. Christians in America have become experts at conviction, but failures at action. And just think about that for a minute. How many times have all of us sitting here in this room either heard some teaching or read something and really been convicted, really felt a genuine sense of desire to want to change? But then how many times have our subsequent actions, or maybe lack of action in some cases, fallen short of our newly felt convictions? And the point that Francis Chan then went on to make, which I think also really applies to what we're studying here, is that while it's clearly a good thing to continue to be fed the truth of scriptures on Sundays and here on Wednesdays in our Bible study, that at some point we need to realize that continuing to just consume the word and to learn more Christian doctrine and to understand the Bible better, that that's not the end goal. That the end goal is putting God's truth into action in our lives. And I think that idea is a great lead-in to the focus that James has on works. James sums up that same thought pretty succinctly in 1:22, writing, "Do not merely listen to the word and so deceive yourselves, do what it says." And I think that's going to be the one global takeaway from our study of James. That's it right there. And I think fundamentally that the issue that James is addressing in those controversial verses in 2:14, when he writes, "What good is it, my brothers, if a man claims to have faith but has no deeds? Can such faith save him?" I think that's the issue he's addressing. And he follows that up after he gives an illustration by writing, "Faith by itself, if it's not accompanied by action, is dead." Now, we know we're saved only because of God's grace and our faith in what Jesus did for us on the cross. He took on our sins so we could be seen as righteous by God. And there is nothing we can do. There's no amount of good works that will allow us to earn our salvation. So it's absolutely true that we're saved only by faith. But as we're going to see in this study, James clearly thinks that works are important. And so that creates a certain tension here as we try to understand and balance two seemingly contradictory ideas, salvation by faith alone on the one hand versus the importance of works on the other. And I think at some level, this tension that we find here between faith and works echoes the tension we found last spring when we were studying Philippians, and we read in 2:12 that to work out your own salvation, fear and trembling. Now, I've mentioned a couple times already that Paul's focus throughout all of his writings was on faith as the sole source of our salvation. But in those verses, he pretty clearly seems to be telling the Philippians something very different, that their salvation was something that they needed to work out. So what did Paul mean there? Well, when I was teaching on that particular passage, one of the things that I talked about is that there are three parts to our salvation. First, there's justification, and there's sanctification, and then finally, glorification. And I think fleshing that out helped explain what Paul meant in that passage in Philippians, and it's also going to help us here, too, as we try and reconcile this seeming contradiction between faith and works. So let me do just a quick overview of this idea. So the first thing that happened in our salvation is we were what's called justified, or seen as being without sin in God's eyes. And that happened in the moment that we put our faith in what Christ did for us on the cross. But our salvation doesn't stop there. It doesn't stop in the moment that we were justified. Throughout the rest of our lives, we continue to go through this process that's called sanctification, in which over time we become more like Jesus. And that's what Paul was referring to when he was telling the Philippians they needed to work out their own salvation. He was referring to this, their sanctification, as something that they needed to intentionally work on throughout their lives. And the same thing's true for us. We need to intentionally work on becoming more like Jesus. That's how we work out our own salvation, even though we were saved only by faith. And as each one of us works out our salvation throughout the course of our lives, it should be evident in how we live and the things that we do. James gives a great illustration of this point. He noted that the Jewish people had always considered their ancestor, Abraham, to be righteous because he believed God. But we all know how Abraham's story goes, right? Abraham proved his faith in God by his actions, first by being willing to leave Ur and move to Canaan, and then later, of course, being willing to sacrifice his precious only son. And what James is saying is that the same thing is true for us. As we begin to look more like Jesus, that should be reflected in what we do with our time. It should be reflected in our actions. And another word that can be substituted for actions is works. So while it's absolutely true that we're saved by faith alone, true faith, as Christina mentioned earlier, it will bear fruit in our lives. And I think that fruit are the works that James is referring to. And I think that's how we can reconcile the perceived tension between these ideas of salvation by faith alone versus the importance of works. True faith and works are not mutually exclusive. They're actually symbiotic. They're woven together with the one naturally leading to the other. That's why James wrote in 2:18, "I will show you my faith by what I do." So to sum up what we're going to be studying this fall, James is going to force us to face the implications of our faith. Hopefully, he's going to inspire us to put our faith into action in our lives. Here's how one commentary described this letter. "It will show us what genuine faith looks like in real life, and it will challenge us about how real faith works hard and lives distinctively." So I'd like to close this morning by paraphrasing another commentary that said that if we really take this letter to heart and we really ask the Holy Spirit to work in our hearts, that we won't be the same people at the end of this study. So will you please close with me together in prayer? Heavenly Father, I thank you for this study. I thank you that you created a place where we can study your word, where we can come to know you better, and we can meet other women who can walk alongside us through life. So I thank you for each and every woman who's here this morning and the ones who weren't able to be here. And I ask that you continue to work in our hearts as we study James, so that you help us to be women who are women of faith, but whose faith is evident in our lives through the things that we do. And I ask you for all these things through your son's name. Woo-hoo!